freeing sexual blocks. If you want to improve your sexual experiences, the last place to start is the bedroom. The best sex is the most open and unplanned. There is no way to practice being spontaneous. To improve your sexual experience, first get rid of your expectations. Sexual energy is neutral. You can associate it with anything, positive or negative, in your life. Whatever you expect sex to be, it will tend to become. In both men and women, the physiology of sex is very delicate and easily influenced by the mind. It is your mind that intervenes to prevent orgasm or potency, leaving aside disease conditions. Yet coming to bed without expectations seems to be impossible given how the mind works. As soon as sex becomes bound up in associations and needs, it is no longer free. Laying orgasm into a certain groove separates it from any spiritual experience. Sex is mechanical when it is without spiritual meaning. For many reasons, it is difficult to align our sexual and spiritual natures. The following exercise is aimed at removing the obstacles or blocks that prevent spirit from entering into sex. When blocks are removed, sexual energy has no choice but to flow. Each of the following statements has a wide range of meanings, but here are the types of blocks generally indicated. Sex is better if it lasts a long time. Fixed expectations from sex, comparison with others, social norms more important than personal experience. Orgasm should be intense. Comparison with the past, valuing of physical sensation over emotions, self-absorption, addictive personality traits. It's not sex without orgasm. Performance anxiety, comparison with past, valuing of physical sensation over emotions. I'm pretty insistent on getting sex when I want it. Hidden anger or sadism, self-absorption, competitiveness. The more orgasms, the better. Performance fixation, wandering attention, emotional immaturity. The best sex I ever had wasn't with my present partner. Disappointment, anger toward partner, discouragement, inability to be present. My partner isn't as open about new positions and techniques as I am. Lack of communication, fixation on fantasy or sensations, judgment against partner. I aim to please. I rarely let my partner down. Performance anxiety hidden by performance success, self-absorption, competitiveness. We have sex more or less often than I'd like. Over-dependence, low self-worth, lack of communication. I miss the way our sex used to be. Lack of communication, outside distractions, estrangement from partner. Rather than hearing any of these characterizations as a diagnosis or judgment, see if they show the way to hidden issues you may not be facing. The point is not to make you feel that there is something wrong with you, only to stir the energies that need to move. In the following list are suggested phrases. Write them down and put a check by any you have had at least once during sex. Delighted laughter, sense of timelessness, ecstasy, merging with partner, floating sensation, loss of ego, complete letting go, sense of wholeness, safety, belonging, bliss, unbounded love, contentment, peace in the center of your heart. Look back over your answers. The experiences you have checked indicate your spiritual horizon. That is, you have learned to use sexual energy to create these experiences. Mark the experiences you haven't had, but think could happen next. These are your spiritual goals. On your inner landscape, you are already working toward them. Now go through the list a third time and mark the experiences you believe are out of reach. This holds up a mirror to your current belief in the limits of love. On the path to love, impossibilities are resolved by turning non-love into love. With spiritual growth comes new creative potential, which can take the form of sexual expression, leading to the realization that you are pure potential, able to fulfill any creative impulse. How to surrender. Spiritually, no action is more important than surrender. Surrender is the faith that the power of love can accomplish anything, even when you cannot foresee the outcome of a situation. But surrendering to another person's ego, even your beloved's, is not a spiritual act. At the level of ego, two people cannot want exactly the same thing all the time. Yet at the level of spirit, they cannot help but want the same thing all the time. The gap between ego and spirit is unavoidable. Bringing them together is achieved through surrender, and the only force that can accomplish it is love. Surrender, then, is the next phase on love's journey, which you enter as soon as you choose to be in a relationship. The majority of people find themselves not in romance, but in a long-term relationship, usually marriage. If falling in love is a brief opening to spirit, long-term relationship is the broad plateau that follows, commitment. The spiritual difficulty of commitment is that it throws you directly into the gap between ego and spirit. Either the two egos must live in an uneasy truce, or they must find another way, surrender. The path to love is not automatic. One must choose day to day to stay on it. The insights that arise in a committed relationship, therefore, are those pertaining to the path. You are on a unique path created between you and your beloved. You find your path by not thinking, feeling, or doing, but by surrendering. Surrender reveals the impulses of spirit beneath the mask of ego. The path to love uses relationships to move you out of your limited sense of I, me, mine, into an expanded identity. This is the growth from self to higher self. There is a fundamental mystery to the soul, that its integrity is not violated by merging with another person. The blending of two spirits brings more to the union than each partner started with. The realization that two can be as one is the essence of surrender. Most people secretly mourn the transition from romance to commitment. Being in a relationship, since it requires patience, devotion, and persistence, is much more difficult than falling in love. Its spiritual rewards are won through dedication to inner growth. Because it is hard, marriage often dwindles in passion. It brings conflict, disappointment, and pain. Yet this is an ego story. The only real difference between romance and relationship, spiritually speaking, has to do with surrender. Being lost in the deliciousness of romance, people have no time to be selfish, no will to distrust. In marriage, the mask of fantasy is stripped away. The ego returns with a vengeance. Therefore, surrender has to become a conscious goal. It is no longer a given. This isn't to say that surrender is hard work. It is conscious work. As such, it can bring the same joy and delight as falling in love. Making your relationship as extraordinary as falling in love is the great challenge of this stage. The most profound reason for committing to another person is also the simplest. Marriage is sacred. On this basis, the husband and wife are able to surrender to each other because they are only surrendering to the spirit in everything. These words sound almost shocking in a modern context. Most marriages struggle just to establish basic personal trust. Yet a sacred marriage, in which both partners surrender to each other as expressions of spirit, is natural. It is the ripening of love's fruit after the blossoming of romance. Surrender in relationship is valuable only as surrender to spirit. Marriage based on differences can never lead to spiritual surrender. Yet the spiritual purpose of differences is to lead you out of separation. Being in dharma, in righteousness, or the way, heals separation by making us a reality, not as a unit of two, but as unified spirit. You're acting in dharma when you allow rather than oppose. allowing results in statements such as these. Is there something you need? How can I help? I see what's going on with you. I want you to know it's okay. Go ahead. I'll be here. You're right. Unity makes another person's viewpoint completely clear. Your beloved isn't outside yourself. She's only outside your ego. At the core, you and your beloved are not separate. Dharma is a vision of spiritual equality. When you perceive life through this vision, separation ends. Being in Dharma signifies that you have set a spiritual goal for yourself and are dedicated to reaching it. As relationships today struggle to survive, they need a new reason to justify themselves, which makes this broader meaning of Dharma essential. When you first think of the word surrender, you probably associate it with defeat. This is a natural association from the ego's viewpoint. But falling in love allows you to surrender to what you deeply desire, not what someone else is trying to impose. Spirit acknowledges the other person's need, but it neither takes responsibility for that need nor opposes it. In this way, the other person is seen as real, because whenever you need something, your need is your reality. The only true need anyone has is to be seen as real. A lot of the time we are lost in unreal needs. Your mate asks you to help clean the house. She could be asking you for dozens of reasons. She may be angry that household work is all left to her. She may feel demeaned, ignored, anxious, controlling, or she may just need help cleaning the house. The absence of ulterior motives is what marks spirit. Does this mean that a spiritual person always gets up to clean the house? No, spirit never acts in a fixed way. In general, to hear that someone you love needs you does result in fulfilling the need. There are certain loving instincts that come naturally when you are in touch with spirit. You don't oppose. You put feelings over results. You put another's wishes on the same plane as your own. Letting go. In practical terms, surrender means letting go. When you let go from this insistent grip on your personal version of reality, new forms of reality can enter. Letting go is a process. You have to know when to apply it, what to let go of, and how to let go. Your ego is going to try to prevent you, since it believes that you have to hold on in order to survive. Your only ally is spirit, which sees reality as a whole and has no need to create realities based on limitation. Releasing yourself into spirit is the purpose of the following exercises. The steps are these. Awareness begins to substitute for reactions. A reaction is automatic. It draws upon fixed beliefs, fears, and expectations. Overcoming this requires an act of awareness, questioning whether you need to hold on to the fear. Reactions result in a closed set of options. Awareness results in an open set of options. Every time you are tempted to react in the same old way, ask if you want to be a prisoner of the past or a pioneer of the future. Strong signals will tell you when letting go is appropriate. Knowing when to let go is obvious once you have awareness. The crucial times to let go are when you feel the strongest urge not to. We all hold on tightest when our fear, anger, pride, and distrust take over. Yet these forces have no spiritual validity. At the times when you were most afraid, angry, stubborn, or mistrustful, your ego is forcing you to react, blinding you to new possibilities. You feel you can't cope anymore. You feel boxed in. You feel you won't survive. These feelings give rise to the rigid, contracted state of resistance, disallowing the reality that good things can happen at any time. Spirit has a good outcome for any situation if you can open yourself to it. A key word to holding on is always. As soon as your mind tells you that something always happens, you are in the grip of a false belief. Always is never true. At any moment, you have the choice to break out of what is really trapping you, your automatic reactions dredged up from the past. If the right time to let go is when you don't want to, the thing to let go of is the thing you feel you must hold on to. Fear, anger, stubbornness, and distrust portray themselves as your rescuers. It is helpful to challenge familiar reactions by stating that you no longer believe in them. Instead of saying, "I have to have my way," say, "I don't know everything. I can accept an outcome I don't see right now." Instead of saying, "I can't stand this," say, "I've survived things like this before." The general formula is that whenever you react with X has to be this way or else, you bring awareness in and say, X doesn't have to be any way except what it is. Since letting go is a deeply personal choice, you're going to have to be your own teacher. You may feel comfortable with a lot more physical release than I do. Finding the right personal balance is important. Letting go physically is a matter of stress release. Under stress, your body tenses and contracts. Hormonal balances switch to the hypervigilant state of fight or flight. Stress is ongoing. Therefore, reducing stress also needs to be ongoing. In the short run, letting go of stress involves relaxing. Take deep, measured breaths, letting the breath go free on the exhale. Your body doesn't like holding on to stress. It does so essentially at the urging of the mind. Under really extreme stress, walk away from the situation. Offer reassurance that you will be back, and give yourself permission to do what you need to do for your own well-being. When you find yourself in a situation in which you are certain of disaster, loss, hurt, or any other negative outcome, use the following formula. This is just an experience. I am here on earth to have experiences. Nothing is wrong. My fears may come true, but the outcome will not destroy me. It may even be good. There is something here for me, if I have the awareness to find it. I am loved. Therefore, I am safe. These are new beliefs that, when sincerely held, call in spirit to aid you. The situations that your ego resists with all its might are precisely the ones that should be embraced, because anything that dismantles your limiting mental constructs is beneficial. There is a law in the unconscious that whatever you avoid will come back, and the more you avoid it, the stronger its return. The refusal to face this fact creates much unnecessary misery. Instead of resisting any emotion, the best way to dispel it is to enter it fully, embrace it, and see through your resistance. Painful emotions return because they are part of you. You created them before pushing them away. The cause of every emotion is in here, which means that inner work can heal it. When you find yourself dominated by a negative emotion, try to release it physically at first. Use the following formulas to reframe your emotion as they apply. Instead of telling yourself that your emotion is bad, ask what it has to tell you. Every emotion exists to help you. Instead of pushing an emotion away, have a closer look. Very often you will find that emotions are layered. Anger masks fear, fear masks hurt. Getting past an emotion means getting through its layers to the root. If you recognize that certain situations always bring the same reaction, ask what you need to learn in order for that reaction to change. Emotions come and go. Realize that each one has a rhythm and allow yourself to be in that rhythm. The best way not to drown is to ride the wave. As you begin to master the art of letting go, your reality will change. It has no choice. In the process of letting go, you will lose many things from the past, but you will find yourself. It will be a permanent self, rooted in awareness and creativity. Once you have captured this, you have captured the world. What about me? If you feel weak and frightened, the last thing you want is for someone else to see you that way. So you put on a mask. In this case, the mask is a word, no, that disguises how very much you want to be loved and understood. In disguised form, this no is saying, love me. Surrender is the key. It brings a message to the other that says, you're not alone. These words are from spirit. As long as the impulse of love is there, you'll want to deliver the message. Being married is very different from courtship. Yet memory reminds you primarily that giving in to someone you love isn't a defeat. It's a joy, bringing much more to you than you are ever asked to give up. The past doesn't end with surrender. The process of letting go is all that spirit needs in order to enter your life. The rest is a ripening of the union between self and the higher self. There is, however, still the enormous issue of how two people can surrender to each other completely. We want to ask how love increases between two souls. Surrender is not achieved until you surrender completely to your beloved. To accomplish this, you must relinquish everything that deprives you of love and nurture everything that comes from love. One way that people deprive themselves of love is attachment. Attachment has two sides. It both includes and excludes. The wedding vow to forsake all others implies not just fidelity, but a life to be shared by two alone. Yet if you look deeper, you will see that love and attachment are not the same thing. Love allows your beloved the freedom to be unlike you. Attachment asks for conformity to your needs and desires. Love imposes no demands. Attachment expresses an overwhelming demand, make me feel whole. Love expands beyond the limits of two people. Attachment tries to exclude everything but two people. The seduction of attachment is that it bestows a sense of security through insulation from the outside world. We too is a tight, enclosed world. Yet attachment has a deeper spiritual meaning. It represents an attempt to reach unity by merging with another soul. When you are in union, no one can really leave you. If attachment worked, people would become whole just by marrying. But this doesn't happen. On the contrary, it is very common for two people to feel that marriage has brought them a double burden of cares. What is required then is a state called non-attachment. Detachment implies indifference, but non-attachment is a state of freedom that preserves and even increases your love for another. Detachment is achieved by not caring. Non-attachment is achieved by allowing, which shows tremendous care. The insights that apply to non-attachment carry us deeper into the spiritual importance of letting go. Attachment is a form of dependency based on ego. Love is non-attachment based on spirit. The more non-attached you are, the more you can truly love. Action that does not bind comes directly from love. All other action comes indirectly from the past. The spiritual equivalent of attachment is called bondage. Bondage is whatever ties you to the illusion of separation. The root of bondage is karma, which in Sanskrit means action. Any action in creation comes under the heading of karma. Karma forms an endless chain of cause and effect, action and reaction. You cannot fall in love at first sight without rejoining a karmic dance whose steps began deep in the past. An example, if I fall in love with you and you spurn me, my longing doesn't just go away. Anyone I love in the future will be filtered through the impression you made upon me. Therefore, my old karma blocks the entry of any fresh flow of love. Karma has been mistakenly interpreted as fatalism. In fact, it is part of the theory of karma that as you sow, so shall you reap. Whatever you put into the universe, the result will be commensurate. If you give away love, love will return. The universe is a place where no debt goes unpaid. Yet, because it stretches over many lifetimes, the karmic balance sheet isn't worked out from day to day. You have to make a bargain with yourself to believe that mercy, grace, and divine love can be experienced before you will perceive them. The truth isn't revealed all at once, but a day doesn't go by that one's faith that love is a real power isn't reinforced. If you live according to the assumption that there is a way, the way will be opened. This is what Christ meant when he said, "Ask, and it shall be given you. Knock, and the door shall be opened unto you." Karma can never be simply a system of reward and punishment, since it is the way to love. The path to love is the same for both saint and sinner, since both must strip away any belief in the roles they are temporarily playing. If I ask, "Who am I?" one answer involves nothing but externals. I'm a man, 49 years old, born in India, and so on. These are all karmic qualities, the results of specific events or actions that pertain to me. Yet, in a more profound way, they do not define me at all. Not the me defined as inner essence, free will, infinite potential. That me, the inner man, stands outside bondage. In no way could the five senses capture it, or the rational linear mind know it. If the theory of karma is valid, then non-attachment is the truest expression of love. If you allow, you let others go in love. If you control, you attach them instead to your own way of doing things, your own beliefs and expectations. When one person is trying to control another in a relationship, he usually doesn't admit what is going on. Instead, his motivations are made to look like love. Isn't it love to protect your partner, look out for her interests, oversee her wants and desires? For many people, this passes as genuine love. A controlling person appears to be free from fear. That is the facade that control presents to the world. We put a high social value on seeming to be in control of our lives, which further promotes the ego's belief that its controlling behavior is working. Yet control never actually solves the insecurity that underlies it. Control increases fear by denying that it exists. Examine the following list in light of your own behavior. Do you keep secrets from your beloved, especially about money? Do you dominate conversation and expect your point of view to be acknowledged as right? When you make a suggestion, are you offended or put off if it isn't taken? In the name of love, we all resort to these unloving behaviors at one time or another. The end of such behavior begins when you see that control is incompatible with love. In the name of love, one person assumes power and the other gives it away. Instead of being drawn closer, however, the couple discover that they feel increasingly distant, for the one with the power becomes guilty or domineering, while the one without power feels resentment and eventually rebels. Control is no solution to the problem of fear. How fear is really solved. Spiritually, the answer to fear is simple. You are already safe. If you felt truly safe, fear wouldn't arise. From the perspective of spirit, all fear is a projection from the past. And as long as these projections continue, you will keep generating fearful situations to accommodate them. Whatever you most fear, abandonment, rejection, failure, loss, humiliation, has already occurred to you. The threats you perceive now are the long shadows cast by your past. Romantic love makes you feel safe because love is there to guard you. Once we grew up, we learned that our parents were not as totally secure in the world as we thought. This usually brought some shock and disappointment. The one lesson, parents can't always protect you, is true, whereas the second, love can't protect you, is not. Unlearning the second lesson is how you stop having to control other people. The love you have for one person is a safe zone and thus a good place to begin. Somehow, miraculously, this one person is enough to cancel out the hostile world. Every day brings many opportunities to replace controlling with allowing. Look at your interaction with your beloved and honestly confront any fear-based behavior that you are exhibiting. When control is ready to loosen its grip, a definite relaxation takes place. The facade of the demanding critical partner begins to melt. At last you find it possible to allow. When this stage is reached with the beloved, the healing process begins to branch out. You stop measuring people by whether they live up to your expectations. You lessen your habit of taking care of others without really caring for them. You begin to listen to objections instead of just using them to trigger your own emotions. You stop holding grudges and remembering slights. Resentment begins to be replaced by tolerance. The most loving thing you can do for your beloved, if he or she is dealing with control, is to encourage these shifts. But this is something no one who is still in a state of need can do. How can you love without need? Know the difference between ego and spirit. Ego is needy, but spirit is not. It exists to give and not take. It wants to bring joy. It has no hunger for approval. When you see yourself this way, your relationship will become sacred. All of us bring needs to relationships, but needs don't have to turn into attachment. Attachment is created when needs aren't understood and faced. Why you have needs is answered by examining how you feel about being in separation. For the underlying anxiety of separation from God, Spirit and the higher self is what created need. When you heal separation, your needs will not reflect fear and insecurity. Inner needs come down to what makes you feel secure, as tested in this questionnaire. Listen to the following statements, preferably with your beloved, and check the conclusion that applies best to you. I would be mortified if my friends found out that I lost my money or had plastic surgery. I would rather be promoted at work or be my ideal weight. I would rather be respected or accepted. I'd like to have my children look back at me as a parent who taught them right from wrong or not to hurt others. The worst thing my enemies could say about me is that I'm weak and incompetent or selfish and uncaring. I'd rather be productive or happy. We will consider the former answers male and the latter answers female. If most answers are from the group that is not your gender, you are likely to be able to define your needs without reference to society's standards. Now, compare your score with your partner's. You need to recognize imbalances where they exist and take responsibility for them. The object is to find the balance of male and female within you rather than attach yourself to someone else's strength as a compensation for your weaknesses. We will now examine how this dynamic can change. Satisfying inner need has to go deeper than what society or your ego tells you will suffice. Inner need must be faced before you can feel secure. To be aware of inner need is healthy. To deny inner need is unhealthy. In the light of spirit, you are wholeness and therefore lack nothing. You are love and therefore must be lovable and desirable. You are unique and therefore cannot be compared with anyone else. In the eyes of spirit, you are always enough. We are now at the level of inner need where the spiritual concept of I am enough is truly critical. As long as you dwell on more superficial levels of needs, the anxiety of separation is disguised, and that may be what you need for the moment. It takes real spiritual commitment to expose the wounds of separation hidden in the unconscious. Keeping away from a psychic black hole seems like a good tactic, but it isn't the same as healing. If left unhealed, a black hole only gets larger until it becomes a gaping wound. Someone who hasn't healed will have no energy to cope with life. There will be a floating sense of dread that drains the vitality of existence. Someone who has great anxiety about their survival won't have much time to seek higher fulfillment. Survival fear is the deepest motivation for attachment. Whenever you feel that you have to hang on and cling to something in order to survive, you are perched over a black hole. Once you face the fear of survival, There is nothing left to cling to. A black hole lies straight ahead. Fortunately, the terror of a black hole can be disarmed. Black holes are healed by filling them with spirit. Despite their terror, black holes are just a lack of love. The following statements express a healing attitude toward any extreme fear or the need it arouses. I do not lack for anything. Fear is always wrong. Even if bad things happen, they will increase my knowledge and strength. My life is mine to take care of. I can do it. Spirit is always my ally. No matter what, I am enough. How does your beloved fit into this? Falling in love gives a taste of what it feels like to be whole and full. Wisdom tells us that this is only temporary. The real spiritual work is to fill this loveless space yourself. The mind can be trained into self-love by being shown over and over that the higher self is a safe haven of love and protection. This begins when you refuse to follow the impulses of anger and fear. Trust that the universe is on your side. Form your desires from the heart and watch the higher self carry them out. Heed the tenderness and the sweetness of your love for others and cultivate the peace of inner silence. When you put these things foremost in your relationships, you will help your beloved towards self-love instead of expecting love to be constantly directed at you. When you have done your spiritual work, you will fill in the black holes that keep you from the source of love, your higher self. Letting go, although frightening to the ego, is actually entering into the boundless ocean of love. There is no way to achieve real contentment, real fulfillment, other than through the higher self. Why we need passion. Up to this point, I have spoken of the cosmic dimension of yourself as a higher self that lives beyond three-dimensional reality. The difference between a cosmic love affair and an earthly one is the difference between play and need. Some amount of need enters into every relationship in the material world. Survival is too pressing an issue. But in spirit, you only play. Your purpose is to express every grain of passion that love arouses in you. In Vedic terms, marriage is the union of God as male with God as female. When these two poles meet, passion flies between them. There was only one divine purpose in dividing into two sexes, and that was the joy of sexual union. Sexual union imitates divine creation. What you express through your passion is God's love for God. What we need to explore next is how a marriage can deepen in spirit to justify its cosmic purpose. In our culture, because we define passion exclusively in sexual terms, people find themselves bewildered when sexual interest fades in their relationships. Relationship should be about uniting yourself with your beloved in a passion for life, not just for sex. Real lasting passion must come from a deeper level. Although most of us consider ourselves fortunate if we can still feel passion about anything as we grow older, feeling passion for your work or politics or even sex is not the same as having a passion for life. It is not just that life is bigger than work, politics or sex. A passion for life implies that you are passion. It is in your very being. A passion for life is a passion for completeness. This means at the most primal level, merging the male and female within oneself. The marriage of Shiva and Shakti in Indian cosmology, the male and female principles of creation, is about spiritual potential, nothing less. In men, this means the advent of tenderness, nurturing and trust. Aggression and violence will become unnecessary as the shadow energies they disguise, fear and impotence, come to the surface to be recognized and healed. For women, the journey to wholeness is different, because a woman must build up her energies so long forced into submission by society. A woman needs to allow herself however much time it takes to use Shakti energy to accomplish what has been reserved for the male ego. Women have been given their femaleness to accentuate the difference between Shakti, which is subtle and spiritual, and brute force. Having already touched on the concept of a sacred marriage, now we can expand that concept by looking at the energies of Shiva and Shakti. They are a divine whole that chooses to express itself by taking on the appearance of being masculine and feminine. You and I do the same thing. Although my body may be male, my inner self identifies with spirit as a whole, and therefore my soul must include both Shiva and Shakti. To remain stuck in gender stereotypes, to aim criticism at the other sex for causing problems, these are betrayals of marriage's sacred foundation. A sacred marriage draws its passion from inclusiveness. Passion for another person has to fade, but passion for life itself is eternal. When the two cosmic energies, Shiva and Shakti, are connected, the flow of passion brings unlimited creative potential. You are the ground for this current to flow. It needs no one else. Only when Shiva and Shakti are married in you will you be able to enter a sacred marriage with someone else. Anyone who is connected with spirit has Shakti, which manifests in five ways that God herself manifests. Described in the ancient Shiva Sutras, these are the five powers. Chitta Shakti, the awareness of God. Ananda Shakti, the bliss of God. Ichha Shakti, the desire to unite with God. Gyan Shakti, knowledge of God. Kriya Shakti, action directed toward God. A sacred marriage would also derive its passion and energy from the five Shaktis, and in the same order as God herself discovered them. Setting your spiritual priority straight means preserving being first and action last. Being, in this case, means identifying with spirit. Action means identifying with career, accomplishment, and the daily give and take of life. The silence of Shiva, motionless, uncaused, non-attached, hardly seems to us the model of masculine power. Masculine power isn't the same as male behavior, however. The aggressiveness of a warrior doesn't correspond to Shiva, who has no need to intrude, conquer, overcome, or compete. Shiva is best understood as omnipresence, a silent awareness that permeates everything. In the setup of things, Shiva was given Shakti to carry out the physical process of creation. This is strikingly evocative of the way the code of life is packaged in each cell of your body. As DNA, silent, inactive, and out of sight, and RNA, which emerged out of DNA, to carry out all the cellular processes that actually build the body. On a cosmic scale, you have Shiva, whose creative potential remains infinitely greater than any of its expressions, even galaxies and whole universes. Shiva brings pure consciousness to a sacred marriage. It invisibly makes every action an action of God. Hidden within every action is an action of God. Hidden in every event of your life is the possible epiphany about love as it communicates to you from the source. If second attention, intuition if you will, is acute enough, you can be aware of the spirit crossing your path, uplifting you, or whispering truths many times a day. These are all silent communications from Shiva, whose nature is silence. As with Shakti, there are some simple verbal formulas to indicate what Shiva's actions are trying to impart. Creation, God's love is new. Destruction, God's love is beyond death. Maintenance or protection, God's love upholds. Concealment, God's love is beyond form. Revelation, God's love is in form. The greatest sign of God's love is that He wants to be known. Now we come to our deepest definition of passion. Passion is the free flow of awareness from the unmanifest to the manifest. Your life appears to be a tapestry of outward events, ranging from birth to death. But all this activity depends entirely upon the invisible flow of awareness working on every level. Shiva and Shakti are eternally married because both are composed of awareness. One is awareness resting in silence, the other is awareness flowing out into creation. This is what I mean by saying that your passion itself, for you marry silence and power, the two polarities between which awareness flows. When you aspire to enter a sacred marriage with someone you love, you're expressing your own nature and nothing less. The manifestations of love will multiply because my lover will become sacred to me. That is why love is called holy, because it expresses wholeness. Heeding spirit. If spirit is sending signals to you, how can you heed them? Second attention gives you the ability to take authorship of your own life, putting you at the center, making the reality you perceive. Signals from spirit all serve the same purpose, to give you back your life as a creator. The attitude toward life of someone who functions as a creator is based on these five cardinal beliefs. I am an empty vessel. Inspiration fills me every day, but I am not here to hold on to anything that comes to me. I am here to pass energy from a lower to a higher state, directing everything towards spirit. I do not have to control the flow of reality. I bend where spirit bids me. The fullness of spirit, not my ego, provides. If I live from the source of creation, only good can come to me. Everything from spirit comes from love. Getting to these beliefs and making them work for you is a goal that spirit can help you with. Society in general is not attuned to such a life, but living in separation cannot bring you to unity. Spirit is your chief and only ally in your quest for unity. The tactics of non-love will never get you to love. The voice of spirit is constantly competing with other voices inside you, and the outcome of your life depends on which voice you will follow. The whole business of inner voices is highly complex, but from spirit's viewpoint, the only inner voice you need to follow is that of the higher self. To see if you are heeding that voice, listen to this list of statements and check which ones have applied to you over the last 2 days. I decided to go it alone on something that matters to me. I had a great new idea. I said, "I love you." I swallowed my pride and admitted I was wrong. I stood up for myself even though I felt nervous about it. I searched deep inside. My faith in God was justified. I was at peace. The more statements that apply, the more in tune you are with spirit. Spirit's voice is harder to follow because it is neither loud nor demanding, whereas the voice of fear, for instance, is at times overwhelming. But it is you who decides which voice to heed and which to reject. Getting rid of the negative voices in your head isn't accomplished by arguing with them or ignoring them. It involves a process of letting go. Here I will be concerned with how you attune yourself to the voice of spirit. Ask yourself the following questions. Am I angry or anxious? Am I suspicious or doubtful? Has this happened to me before? Am I just repeating a past scenario? Do I feel I'm in danger? These are signals from your ego. It is in the absence of these ego signals that spirit is speaking to you. Transmuting your behavior from ego-based to spirit-based means cultivating your second attention. You will see results that you never expected. Your fears will no longer come true. Your happiness will no longer depend on expectations. You will feel safe. You will feel loved. As you begin to heed spirit, you can only increase in love. Passion for life will appear naturally. Love unites two people more and more in a spiritual reality unknown outside their intimacy. They have reclaimed their lives by becoming authors of their own reality. Passion doesn't just fade, it gets blocked. And you have to ask why you blocked it. The answer, almost always, is rooted in the past. To a surprising extent, we have all learned to approach passion with caution, as something that may hurt us. An unconscious sensor inside your mind decides whether it's permissible for you to feel passionate or not. Boredom begins when you allow yourself to feel little or no emotional stimulation, and from there stem the reactions of dullness, lethargy, and depression. Pinning your frustrations on your mate is like pinning your happiness on him. Neither will work. Where are you going to find passion in yourself? Having found it, you can give to your mate in the way you want him to give to you. This is always the solution. The limits we impose on all our emotions originated with the discomfort of our parents. We formed boundaries by reacting to theirs. Your emotional life therefore reflects the emotional comfort range of parents and grandparents, people who are not yourself. And passion is just the free flow of natural emotional energy. Unless desires are allowed to run their course, existence feels futile. Your mate didn't inflict this on you, it is your own creation. Futility is a depressed condition that signifies what I want doesn't matter, a feeling that you are powerless. Someone with no power feels that desire is hopeless since it will never be fulfilled. Therefore, why bother to have desires in the first place? Some people feel that they were stripped of power by their parents, by destiny, by God. In actual fact, we all disempower ourselves. It is impossible to exist without desires. If desire is denied, however, Shakti is rendered useless. Because the flow of life won't be stopped, a counterforce must be called in, fear. Fear at any level of the psyche makes it much more difficult to trust that passion is safe. In relationships where two people have allowed the underground war between fear and desire to go on too long, suppressing passion becomes an actual life goal. It is normal to seek pleasure. A fearful person avoids pain instead. The spiritual answer to boredom is to open yourself to the very thing you have feared, the constant flow of desire that wants to express itself at every moment. We are enticed back into passion when we admit to having desires. When the passion is gone from a relationship, both partners must be honest in stating that they have desires. The critical step is to eliminate your partner as the cause of the problem and take responsibility for your own feelings. By taking blame out of the question, you also remove threat. You cannot help but fear anyone whom you are mentally attacking. If you are honest, you will hit upon love, even if it is only the tiniest spark. Put your newfound feelings at the feet of your beloved. Express kindness in the smallest of ways. In this way, you encourage a fragile new emotion to believe that it has a right to exist. The relationship that seems to frustrate and kill desire turns into the healer of desire. I have a special name for this kind of healing. Wooing the goddess. It is the return of spirit within you. If you don't feel at one with the goddess, woo her back. Win her before you try to win anyone else. Go into the fear and hurt. Practice letting go of your old beliefs. Learn to forgive yourself. Claim what is good about yourself and not just what is bad. Follow every enthusiasm wherever it leads you, since the source of enthusiasm is always passion. Ecstasy. What we have discussed so far is how to ground a relationship in love through surrender, non-attachment, and the renewal of passion. When two people have such a basis, they are ready for the next stage, ascension. Ascension is based on love's ability to expand to the world of boundlessness. This world becomes transformed into a heaven of fulfillment, ever at peace, ever in love. Ascension is the final stage in relinquishing attachment to separation. As you ascend, your love will turn to ecstasy. To feel ecstasy is the privilege of all those who have walked the path to where ascension begins. It exists as an ideal that is more or less unreachable through any emotion the ego can grasp. It takes us beyond ego. Ecstasy is the final stage of intimacy with yourself. What lovers really heal when they love intimately is the relationship with themselves. Throughout time, you have been seeking to love yourself, heal yourself and find God in yourself. All outer relationships serve this eternal relationship. Eventually, your seeking is done. A moment comes when you experience a merging, as Emily Dickinson so exquisitely describes it. The drop that wrestles in the sea forgets her own locality as I towards thee. This is the crystalline instant in which pure love fuses into pure religious devotion. Ego gives way to pure flow of being. Yet all it represents is a shift in awareness, a final perception of who we are. The insights of ecstasy have much more to do with the final expansion of consciousness than with any feeling or emotion, however remarkable. Ecstasy carries you completely outside your ego boundaries. In ecstasy, you know yourself as cosmic ego, unbounded in time and space. The end of love's journey returns to the source of all awareness, power, and being. We begin to live in fullness only after liberation. A liberated soul is a citizen of the universe. Impossible as it is to convey ecstasy through the poor power of words, we can sense what it is because all of us live from that sweet point in our hearts. Whatever seems to be happening on the outside, every person wants to hold on to that spot forever. When we succeed in getting there permanently, the transformation goes beyond self to change the world. The true definition of ecstasy is a spiritual release. Spiritual ecstasy is not a feeling or an idea, but a shift of perception in which direct contact with spirit is made. The biblical injunction, "Be still and know that I am God," is an invitation to ecstasy. I prefer the spiritual definition because it is inclusive of the physical and the mystical. What makes ecstasy so intense and extreme is not the experience itself, but getting to it. The exquisiteness of true ecstasy cannot dawn unless we can contain it. Our minds are absorbed in relentless activity. The body is also active and restless. The body generally registers some degree of agitation as it moves into alignment with spirit. What may be an expansion of the soul into infinite space may seem like a terrifying fall into the void. Ecstasy is the release of individuality back into wholeness. Whatever brings you closer to wholeness brings you closer to ecstasy. Here I think we've reached the secret of ecstasy. Although often experienced in the most extreme situations, ecstasy is a quality of spirit as natural as any other. The patient work of inner growth is all we need. The emergence into stillness can take place under any conceivable circumstance. Medieval saints found theirs in complete retreat from the world. At this very moment, someone is finding it in a bustling city. Tastes of ecstasy come and go, yet attaining complete stillness of the mind means walking the spiritual path to its conclusion. Expansion of consciousness is the road to ecstasy. Expansion of consciousness is a broad term that covers almost everything I have discussed up to now. Many of the most important themes have already been covered. Seeing your beloved as a mirror of your higher self. Surrendering to love as a guiding force. Letting go of attachment to the false self and its needs. Devoting every day to achieving true union and healing the wounds of separation. Only at moments when your boundaries fade away do you have flashes of reality. Then direct intuitive knowing becomes possible, and you can see yourself for who you are, sublime and ecstatic. When self-realization dawns, there is no longer any question of struggle or effort. The spirit guides you to do whatever is called for. In reality, universal love requires only that the sweet point in the heart expand until bliss and peace become the nature of our life. This first happens within individuals, then to relationships based on spirit, and finally to whole families and societies. A single point in the heart can expand to liberate the world. Ecstasy is a glimpse of the wholeness waiting to be seen everywhere. if one had to lay down some kind of pattern for how ecstasy is attained, it would be extremely general as follows. The time comes when seeking is over and realization begins. First, the mind becomes aware of its own activity while standing apart from it. The first stage of ecstasy is just this faint awareness of being a witness to the usual mental drama rather than an engaged participant. The second step is the stilling of the mind. What creates stillness in the mind is simply that the observer is able to continue to stand apart for longer than a moment. There is a kind of trembling anticipation that can go one of two ways. Either a new thought will be born to bring back the internal dialogue, or the faint trembling of silence will lead to an even deeper silence. Poised here at the edge of ecstasy, you cannot make your mind choose one way over the other. But if the mind chooses to plunge into deeper silence, the third stage has been reached. One experiences it like the softest black velvet or the deepest dark cave. You are there where ecstasy is. The fourth and final stage requires nothing new on your part. Once your attention has been captured by deep silence, the inner transformation is complete. Whatever is to happen next dawns of its own accord. One is brought face to face with pure being, pure awareness, pure joy. The fact that ecstasy exists is the promise that kindles our faith on the path to love. Eventually the path ends, and the foundation of our world, which stands upon memory and mind, crumbles, leaving a new world of unimaginable realness. One moment of genuine ecstasy removes a lifetime of doubts. You realize once and for all that spirit is real. You know from first-hand experience that you are the divine essence. Yet ecstasy is the most immediate and also the most far-off of experiences. It is immediate because it is undeniable. It is distant because it will take a lifetime to secure ecstasy as a permanent reality. Fortunately, this journey itself creates ecstasy, being the path to love. Cultivating inspiration. Ecstasy is delivered in a moment of inspiration. The root word of inspire means to breathe in, which implies that inspiration should be as natural as breathing. The following exercises show you how to summon inspiration and make it your own long before you reach the end of the path. Think of an inspired moment in your life when you said the perfect thing, had the perfect idea. What made you different in that moment? You were open to something new. You weren't reliving the past or anticipating the future. You felt optimistic and open. You felt connected. Now ask yourself if you feel that way now. If you did, you would be in the moment. The same preconditions take everyone into the moment. A genius like William Blake may see infinity in a grain of sand. Try the following meditation. Hold a grain of sand in your hand, imaginary in case none is handy. Let your eye rest upon it. Notice its color and facets, any hint of glitter. Now think of your grain of sand as a point surrounded by space. How much space can you imagine? The room you are sitting in, your neighborhood, your town, the planet, galaxy, and blackness beyond. Allow yourself to see that there is no edge to outer space, no boundary in time. Your grain of sand is the center of the universe. Now repeat the meditation using time instead of space. Imagine the day stretching before and the rest of the day stretching after. See time as an expanding circle and allow it to expand as fast as it wants. Your grain of sand is the center of time, expanding infinitely in all directions. If time and space are centered on one grain of sand, then you have seen infinity. Let your mind go blank and allow the sensation of time and space to race away from the center point. Sense the state of your mind. Is it open, watching, alert? Is it reliving the past or anticipating the future? Do you feel connected? Give it some time. This meditation opens the mind, easing your old ego boundaries. You are using this point of focus, the grain of sand, to slip out of the net of time and space. Beyond the net lies openness, eternity. When two people come together in love, they weave a fabric of consciousness. Each loving thought and action is a thread added to the fabric. In Sanskrit, the word for thread is sutra, which also has a metaphysical meaning. A sutra is an aphorism that expresses some fundamental truth about consciousness. You and your beloved have privileged moments in which you understand what your love is. Your inspirations are yours alone. You need to know how far you have come on the path together. Sutras can tell you this. The exercise here is to write down your inspirations as they come to you. These are threads from which the fabric of consciousness is woven. Get yourself a notebook in which you will put your sutras as well as record those of others that inspire you. Set aside some time when you feel receptive. The early morning works for most people. Let your mind relax. Have the intention to express what you know, a spark of truth from your higher self. The purpose of your sutras is to simply express where you are. You will have immense pleasure watching your spiritual vision grow. The following are some sutras I have written over the past year. I wrote them in spare moments, on airplanes, waiting for lost luggage, or sitting by the sea. If I could wish one thing for myself, it would be that I weave this fabric of consciousness forever. What is more thrilling than the prospect of truths you do not yet know? Lessons for lovers. Three things are absolute and cannot be destroyed: awareness, being, and love. Love is the impulse of evolution that expands life. If you block your desires, you block your natural avenue of growth. The mind judges what is good or bad. Love brings only good. Everything in the outer world contains a message about the inner world. If you create any open space within yourself, love will fill it. No one is wrong. In the eyes of love, all people are doing the best they can from their own levels of consciousness. The whole of reality is contained in the present moment. The inevitable question is why we want to expose our vulnerable, conflicted selves to someone else. Because we want to love. We take the risk, we walk out into the light and offer ourselves to a beloved. This feels wonderful, but when things get tough, we run back inside ourselves. We choose the familiarity of fear and lovelessness over the vulnerability of love until we feel safe enough to go back and try love again. That is essentially the rhythm of every intimate relationship: risk and retreat, until finally something miraculous happens. We look around and we are living in light. Love has silently been weaving our higher and lower natures, blending fear, anger, survival, and protection into the energies of devotion, trust, compassion, and acceptance. The tragedy is that our culture doesn't teach us to see love and marriage this way, so not enough people ever finish the path. If you really love someone else, there is no other way to grow. Knowing that the path is the search for love, you have to devote some time every day to this search. You must place your beloved above yourself in order to deserve a vision of her sacredness. You must tread lightly on the path, having patience with setbacks and harming no one who seems to block you. You must experience your shadow and learn from it in order to go beyond it. All of this is how we build a house of light. There is nothing more moving than a reminder that spirit is with us. The medieval poet Rumi was being quite literal when he said, "There is someone who looks after us from behind the curtain. In truth, we are not here. This is our shadow." The tragic illusion of everyday life is that we mistake shadow for reality. it is impossible to be outside the web woven of love. And at moments when events throw us too far into oblivion, a message comes to say, "You are loved." It still amazes me how often spirit sends clues about the real nature of life. Compassion, the closest value to love itself, is not to take pity, it is to extend care to others simply because you see their need. There is no question of anyone else having to deserve your compassion. If you have it to give, you will give it where it is needed. The path to love doesn't end with ascension. Ascension continues as long as you live. Through ascension, the ideals of trust, forgiveness, devotion, and compassion ripen into a golden harvest. And whatever aspect is revealed at a given moment, they ripen because they have to. I don't think compassion is very well understood. In the West, we have been misled by the word itself. The Latin roots of compassion mean to suffer with. Yet compassion does not have to entail suffering alongside someone else. To be in touch with God's love is the root of compassion. Trying to exercise compassion without this connection will only lead to failure. Compassion has to be founded on unconditional love, which is not attached to suffering of any kind. Even if you are presently in pain, you are not without love. Since God is compassionate, no one's experience of pain is a punishment. This is where compassion has most value. It allows me to step in and remind you that you are loved. By bringing compassion to you, I can reassure you that you are not abandoned. You are just at a difficult crossroads on the journey of love. At every stage of love, the goal should be kept in mind. Uniting romance, relationship, and ascension is a code of compassion which goes. Be kind to yourself and others. Come from love every moment you can. Speak of love with others. Remind each other of your spiritual purpose. Never give up hope. Know that you are loved. If you practice these few things, you will be open to receive every lesson on the past in the spirit in which it is given, as an expression of divine love. The horrors of the world are undeniable, and few people even dream that they will go away. But they will, because love is the supreme reality, compared to which all else is temporary, fleeting, and unreal. The love you seek is seeking you at this moment. Your longing, your deep fantasies about being loved are mere shadows of the melting sweetness that makes spirit want to love you. Be honest about your seeking and be alert to the moments when love is showing itself to you. You are the only means that love has for conquering its opposition. Therefore, you are infinitely precious in the eyes of spirit. The messages of love may not be clear to anyone else around you, even those most intimate to you. That doesn't matter. They are meant for you and you alone. Be assured of that. And above all, keep looking for clues.
Look for other titles by Deepak Chopra available on audio from Random House. Among them are Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, Creating Health, and The Way of the Wizard, all read by the author, and The Return of Merlin, read by Simon Jones, with a special introduction by the author. This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.